This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It is episode 238 with Rainey Knutson, part one of two. If that name doesn't ring a bell to you, she is the founder and editor of Glass Tire, a very popular Houston-based online arts magazine, which you may have heard me mention on occasion in the Weislinks, because I have definitely quoted from them in the past. And it's great to have our first Texas, specifically Houston-based guest. It's been way too long for that to happen. Apologies, Texas and Houston in particular. And we first connected because she actually sort of circuitously came into contact with me because I read fully from her piece from about a year ago called My Fears and Their Assuagements, which she wrote for Glass Tire. And we only got to the first point, the first of the listicle from that one in this conversation, but it led to a, hopefully you will find, very interesting analysis of criticality towards art as artists and otherwise, comparing the Texas and particularly Houston art community with LA's and beyond, and a little bit on Mark Rothko, a little bit of criticality on Mark Rothko, just to give you a warning, trigger warning. On the back end today, not only do we have some fantastic old news, but we also have a blurb that I found right after last episode ran, rents for one bedrooms in the 10 costliest markets and their changes. So I think you'll be interested to hear about that. I'll give you a little bit of a brief update on the Mapplethorpe movie, which I made reference to in the last episode, particularly a quote from the actor Matt Smith, who plays Mapplethorpe. And of course, we'll have the old news. But before we jump into the first part of our conversation with Rainey Knutson, I recently received an email from listener Carl E. Smith, who runs River Gallery in the Echo Park area here in Los Angeles. I wanted to share what he wrote to me with you. He wrote, "I would like to suggest you have a $10 a month membership option. I would gladly spend that and believe others would as well. Thank you again for such inspiring and insightful conversations. I teach workshops for emerging artists, and I always encourage your podcast." This was a later email. "I believe there are people out there that would simply support for more. Your podcast is an important part of my art world." And in a later message still, he wrote to me, "Keep up the excellent work. I think what you're doing is an incredible service to artists and art professionals. You deserve more credit and more funding." To which I say, thank you very much, Carl. I couldn't agree with you more. And I just want to use that opportunity to let you know about the new $10 a month Patreon membership option, which includes an additional bonus, which is an artwork that goes along with all the other bonuses. And you can find it in detail by going to the website, theconversationpod.com, clicking on the support page, and you just scroll down a tiny bit. You will see under donations the link to Patreon. And it'll take you to, if you go to the right column of the Patreon page, you'll see the various membership points. It's changed slightly. It's now $1 a month. You can donate for as little as $1 a month, $5 a month, and $10 a month, this new one that we're talking about. And if you think of it as an extra two fancy coffees a month, you know, over the course of a year, $120, I think it's definitely doable for maybe 20 of you. That would be amazing. So I encourage you, if you are a fan of this show and you get a lot out of it, as Carl described, to join that $10 a month level, membership level. And I will shower all kinds of praise and thanks and gifts upon you when you do. Thank you very much in advance for that. More on the back end. Let's jump into the conversation, part one, with Rainey Knutson right now. And as we jump in, I'm asking Rainey about the history of Glass Tire. How gradual, I guess, I mean, in sort of the most concise way you can put it, how gradual was it that it became kind of your thing and, you know, turned into the online version of a magazine that you were the publisher of?
Gosh, it was fairly gradual. And there were certainly times along the way, you know, it's been, this summer it will have been 19 years since I bought the URL. There were certainly times along the way that I wanted to quit, no doubt about it. It's hard to answer that question only because when I think back to the beginnings of it, the internet was so different. I mean, doing a website was so different. So what we think of when we think of online magazine today is very, very different from what we thought of. We wouldn't have even said online magazine in 2000 or 2001. So, but I would say the first editor came on board. I was not alone for the first time in 2003. Mm-hmm. Rachel Cook was our first editor. And it really started to gain momentum, I would say, sort of in the mid-aughts. But we, you know, over the years, from the time that we started, there were still salaried critics at all of the dailies in Texas. And the last one of those, Jean Claire Van Ryzen in Austin, was, you know, left the Austin American Statesman last year. So the landscape of criticism was very different.
I guess maybe a more direct way of asking the question about the evolution of Glass Tire is, at what point did it become your full-time living?
Oh, well, I had worked in the rug industry. I had a side hustle in the rug industry for a long time. And there was a point at which I might have quit Glass Tire and gone fully into the rug business. Rugs are really, really seductive, wonderful objects and so much fun. The rug business is no less financially unrewarding than the online arts journalism business. So it's not like it would have been a big sacrifice one way or the other to do that. Mm-hmm. But really, in many ways, my heart was in doing this. And you know, my heart was in literature, which is my educational background. So I would say, I can't remember what year I quit that job, like fully quit it, and this was what I was doing. But it was probably about 7, 8, 9 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, as great as the rug business was for you, I can't imagine too many rug fairs and rug, you know, promotional events were inviting you cross country to appear and cover them.
Well, no, yeah, and I wasn't doing journalism about rugs. I was actually in the rug business, like buying and selling.
Well, there are no rug.
Although there are rug fairs. There are rug fairs.
Uh-huh. Did you go to one?
Oh, yeah. There was the Lexington Avenue Armory one, which I don't know if they're still going. And then Atlanta had like the big rug fair. For some reason, it was in Atlanta.
What's it like being at a rug fair versus being at an art fair?
Well, at a rug fair, it's all wholesale. And the buyers are just therefore sellers themselves. And it's just a lot. There are probably some designers who bring their clients to rug fairs, but I mean, the sort of bullshit factor is significantly reduced at a rug fair.
There we go. All right, we finally got you talking. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the reason that we sort of connected, and I'm glad we did, because I read from your piece that you wrote, I assume, on Glass Tire, My Fears and Their Assuagement, mm-hmm. from May of 2018. And why not I have you read a few of them, and then we can kind of, after each one, we can kind of maybe talk about it for a bit. So
sure.
Why don't you start with number one, please?
Okay, and this was a little bit of a private joke, because this article is a list, a numbered list, and therefore it's a listicle.
Right.
But it's also one of the most personal things that I've ever written, and it was a little scary to put it out there, frankly.
Can I ask you, maybe before you even start reading from it, what kind of feedback you got?
Really nice feedback. It was funny. There were a lot of comments, both, you know, on the site and then just personally people reaching out to me saying like, oh, it's okay, don't worry. And I titled it My Fears. It's not like fear of a tarantula or something. It's I guess deeper and more existential than that. But, you know, last year was, I don't know, I think because we were heading up to the midterms and the political climate, and also just feeling discouraged about the art world, what's happened to art. It all was coalescing in the heat of the summer in Houston.
Yeah.
Okay, so number one on my listicle. I'm afraid I'll never really be moved by a work of art again. This one is evergreen. The more art I experience, the more seldom I find true pleasure in it. This has to do with proficiency at looking, which is one of the recompenses for having one's body start to fall apart in middle age. Fortunately, I never have to live with this worry for very long. Some wonderful idea or essay or painting always emerges, deus ex machina-like, from somebody's wonderful brain that captivates me. This week, it was a musical 1-2 punch, stumbling onto the delicious song Ojos del Sol by a Portland band called Illa Bamba, and of course, Childish Gambino's powerful video This Is America, which I watched obsessively for the better part of an hour, and then watched again the next day and the next.
Okay, let me stop you. Good. Thank you. I really related to this because, and you and I are about the same age, and my takeaway is the longer you look at art, and maybe the more critically as well along the way, the harder it is to be moved by it. And this is something, a sentiment that came up a long time ago with somebody else on the podcast. But tell me if I'm not too far off base in terms of one of the interpretations of what you were saying.
No, I think that that's true. I think that that is one of the things that happens. The longer you look, the better you get at looking. It, like anything else, you know, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And so you're able to discern more. And I think that one of the ways that it's tempting to take refuge from this problem is to retreat into older art. And I've definitely given myself over to that temptation sometimes of just going to a museum and just looking at the older art, because typically what you're going to see in a museum has been vetted and over time, and it's just better examples of whatever was being made at that time. With contemporary art, you know, you're having to sift through it on your own. And I often talk about how there's a lot of bad art. The truth is there's so much competent art out there. And someone told me recently, I was talking about this recently, someone said, oh, Christopher Knight wrote something about all this competent art. I couldn't find it. I looked for it online. But there, it's not that the art is so bad. It's just that there's so much art that's like, oh, that's, you know, it's all right. Mm-hmm. But it's not pushing the ball forward, if you'll forgive the sports metaphor. And so it's harder and harder and harder to be really blown away by a work of art.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And, you know, ideas that I found funny or interesting, like funny little ideas, art about art ideas, things that are making a specific comment about a specific pop cultural reference. You know, I may have responded to that kind of art much more in my 20s, but today I'm just not interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's obviously no accident that the 1-2 punch that you stumbled across were both music and no art to be mentioned.
Well, I do see great art. I do think that there's great, great art. I'm working on an essay right now about some art that I think is really great. So it's not like I'm not worried about art. I don't think that great art doesn't exist. I do think it's getting harder to find it within the art world, though.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was my point, that you've become quite disillusioned with what the art world or what fine art has to offer in terms of art. You're using art in the larger sense of the word and not specifically just in fine art. You're talking about all art in all different arts fields.
Yeah, I'd hesitate to apply the word disillusion to myself. And the art that I'm speaking of, it is visual art. It's an artist named Jim Pirtle here in Houston who's doing this faux scientific stuff that I think is really, really smart. No, I think visual art, I'm not saying that visual art, I'm disillusioned with visual art. I don't feel that way whatsoever. I just feel like we're definitely choking on this fire hose glut of competent art out there.
Okay, I'm trying to parse the difference between, maybe I just didn't articulate it correctly, but choking on the fire hose of competent art, is that what you said?
Yes.
Thank God you have a writing background, because you're definitely bringing the metaphors and the similes. But I don't see how far off I would have been by saying that you're, you know, I don't see how that's not being... Maybe disappointed by art rather than disillusioned by art, it sounds like.
I'm not disappointed or disillusioned by art. I'm I just hesitate to use those words, but it's the art world, you know, and I think that this is, I think I'm very much not alone in this. I think a lot of people are tired of what has happened in the art world. This is one of the advantages of living in Texas, is we're shielded from the worst excesses of it by far. We're far away from all that. I think that it's very complicated, and it's easy to say, oh, the market, or oh, auction houses, or oh, collectors. I think it's a much bigger issue that has to do with schools and the idea of art being a career and us having lost. I think the art world, and again, I'm painting with a broad brush when I say that. I think many people who work in what we understand as the art world don't think about what art really is, what function it really serves. And I think that they just deal in objects that resemble what we have traditionally understood as art, but these are just, it's just high-end decoration or whatever. And there are many so-called artists who are producing this stuff who, by the way, have terrible school loans they've got to pay off, so they got to crank it out.
Yeah. And going back to Glass Tire, and one line of questioning or thinking that I didn't, that I failed to mention, is that you were starting, I mean, obviously you had already started something, a print magazine before Glass Tire, and obviously other things were going on. But whether it was your intention or not, Glass Tire became this center point of art journalism for Texas and even the middle of the country at large, it seems like. Is that, whether or not that's something you believe, is that something that you've been told at some point?
I think that is true, and I think that the reason for that is simply because we have survived for so long. And I think, and of course, you know, fighting against becoming institutional ourselves and our mindset is something that we really have always worked on. Maintaining our fearlessness, maintaining our truthfulness, maintaining our integrity, our editorial integrity is really important. I don't know about the whole middle of the country, though, because we really don't cover that much outside of Texas.
Right. Okay. Well, that said, to what extent has your coverage over the years, particularly the last 10, let's say, included coverage outside of Texas? Because I presume that you have been going to art events outside of Texas from time to time, if not yearly, right?
Oh, yeah. The whole staff, I mean, usually somebody's at the Armory Fair, somebody's at Freeze, New York. Somebody, at least two people go to L.A. at least once a year. You know, we're trying to keep on top of New York and L.A., certainly. And then more close to home, you know, we sent someone to Crystal Bridges, or I went to Prospect in New Orleans last year. Mm-hmm. It is thundering here. I don't know if you're able to hear this thunder, but we've got some weather coming in. Okay. It might pick up on it. I don't know. It sounds like there's a rainstorm blowing in, so you may hear that. So we definitely, or Mexico City, you know, we definitely try to get out regionally and nationally and you know, regionally, including Mexico for us, and see stuff for sure, because you can't just see what's going on in Texas and think you have a handle on it.
Right.
You know, if you think about the geographic area that we're covering, it is huge. And so it's a lot just, yeah, getting around Texas for sure.
Yeah. And when you go, let's just talk about you personally, when you go away to wherever, whether it's Mexico or New York or LA or San Francisco or whatever, and you come back over the years, are there any takeaways maybe that you have in terms of perspective? I mean, and let me preface that a little bit more by saying, referring back to what you said earlier about being shielded from the quote-unquote art world to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Which is a conscious choice being in Texas, by the way. It's not like, we just fucked up and ended up here because we didn't have the gumption to get ourselves to New York or anything like that. I think what you were speaking of being less and less excited about art the more you look at it is certainly true in Chelsea, is certainly true in, you know, Hollywood or the Arts District in LA. I mean, I think that the more you look, the more you're like, oh yeah, I remember this from 20 years ago. I think that the art that is the best art that's being made in Texas by Texas-based artists, let's say, is every bit as good as the best art that's being made elsewhere. There's just arguably less of it because there are fewer artists here, you know, overall. Mm-hmm. And I would say the percentage of good art to bad art, and people get upset when you say good art and bad art, but whatever, the percentage of good art to bad art is the same here as it is in New York, with the caveat being the museum collections in New York obviously, you know, dwarf anything anywhere else. But outside of permanent collections at public institutions, just in galleries and on the scene, yeah, I mean, most of the art everywhere is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds terrible, but it's true. It's true, you know. And the problem that happens in the art world is the monkey see, monkey do curation, where everyone's just looking at everybody else.
Yeah.
And it and boards of directors and directors themselves and curators don't want to embarrass themselves, and so they are going to find something that's been vetted by another institution.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets to be a big problem.
I guess I just want to clarify, when you say bad art in this context, does that include maybe all that competent art, or are you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you're actually painting using the word bad to paint broadly.
I'm saying it's so rare to see something and be like, oh, god damn, that is a great piece of art. I see many, many things and I'm like, that's a really nice drawing. And that's not bad art. Of course, that's not. And I would never denigrate what that artist is up to and how they're spending their time. I mean, it's a worthwhile thing. It's funny. I was talking to, my mind just went to the issue of begging the question of why even bother. And I was talking to an artist friend of mine yesterday, actually, about what, you know, why bother making art if people like Rainier are out there saying competent art, bad art, whatever. When someone is making really nice paintings or really nice drawings, and I think I would never say don't do that. I would say don't get an expensive MFA if that's what you're going to do. But no, I don't mean to. That sounds crueler than I mean it to sound. You know.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think the underlying sentiment is one that, like I said, it was mentioned by a guest many years ago on the show, a good 6 years ago, that it's so rare when you see something and are really moved by it, you know, contemporary. I mean, some people might have a fetish for, you know, Renaissance art and yet, you know, and go get moved by it at, you know, the Met or whatever, or the LA County Museum. But to see newer, to see contemporary art and that you haven't seen and to be really moved by it is, for you and me at least, a very rare encounter.
Yes, which shows you how hard it is to make great art.
Yeah.
I think the artists who do it successfully, you know, artists see the world differently than I see the world. And they are able to see things that I don't see and somehow manifest those things, whether they be ideas or actual physical things in the physical world or whatever, in some way they make something that draws attention to that idea. And that's very difficult to do well. It's easy to do it, I think, tritely.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very difficult to do it in a deep and meaningful way. But that being said, There are a lot of artists who I think are wonderful draftspersons, you know, or who are pretty darn good at. There's a thunder here, Houston rainstorm. Artists who are good at pushing paint around a canvas, and part of me wants to say like, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't do that, but part of me, the truth of the matter is I'm interested in greatness. I'm interested in finding greatness. As a critic, that's what, it's like you're looking for that endorphin high that you get from good art, and that's always what you're looking for. And when an art falls up short or pulls up short, comes up short, you know, there's an unavoidable disappointment, I suppose. So you're looking for that aha flash of recognition that And when to me that profound experience with a work of art is when a work of art resonates with something that you know and understand, and furthermore does it in a way that you didn't see previously, but when it shows it is so obvious. How could I not have articulated that the way that looks to myself before, but I needed an artist to point it out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's rare.
So you call yourself a critic. I mean, I imagine you have a few different titles maybe you use, but it really pricked up my ears when you referred to yourself as a critic, because I feel like a lot of the writing of yours that I've seen is much more journalistic, and you know how critic has that certain pointy association that it seems like you would not want to embrace too much.
I don't mind pointiness. I do mind academia. Are you referencing all the famous academic art critics of the 20th century? Do we need to talk about Clement Greenberg?
Maybe inadvertently, but more just, you know, the judger, you know, the person who, I mean, I guess ultimately that's what you're doing when you're, you know, even if it's an online arts magazine, the stuff that you're writing about. I mean, why don't I put the question this way? How much of the reviews that you've published, both personally and your colleagues on Glass Tire, of shows have been takedowns or you know, heavily critical?
Negative.
Both, yeah.
Well, it's funny you should ask. We actually did a study because we were getting a lot of feedback that Glass Tire was too negative. And so we did a study and we found that 1 in 10 of our reviews from the previous 3 years was actually negative. Another 3 in 10 were just neutral or sort of, you know, or mixed, let's say, and like 6 were positive. But people would just remember negative. People remember negativity. I mean, it's just hardwired in our biology. That's what we remember. That's what takes root in our minds.
Yeah.
So you can, and if you only write positive reviews, you get accused of being a cheerleader, you know, a brainless cheerleader. But I will say back to this thing, you know, you said something about judging, and I think people shy away from that term. Oh my God, who am I to judge? You know, to quote Pope Francis, as he put it so beautifully, in a completely different context. but the fact of the matter is, we judge all the time. When I go into, I mean, tell me the person who goes and looks at art and isn't internally making an assessment of whether they like it or not. You're judging when you look at art.
Mm-hmm.
I assume. I'm judging when I look at old art. I'm judging when I look at new art. So to say that you don't make judgments to me is to deny that which makes one of the things that makes us special as human beings, our ability to, you know, rationally make distinctions between two things. So I think judging shouldn't be something that we're afraid of saying that we do. It's not when it comes to art.
That's a great point. I mean, who among artists is not judging shows that they've seen? It's the difference is that the critic has it published for everyone to see. And
yes,
they have to think harder about it.
Yes, it has to be defensible. You know, if you do a good job with a negative review, you have made your point clearly and hopefully somewhat dispassionately. And the other thing is I always tell people who write negative reviews, just be prepared for the backlash. But on the other hand, you put your negative review out there to begin with. So if you get backlash, you know, it's fair. All is fair.
Yeah.
And we always, we never publish negative reviews that somebody doesn't say, well, wait a minute, you know, and come in on the comments and argue with the author. And that's the internet, you know, that's the discourse. From the Latin discursus to and fro, you know, that's the conversation and forum of the internet.
What was your assessment of your percentage breakdown that you had? 1 out of 10 was negative, 3 or 4 were neutral, and 6 were positive. Did you feel like that was the right ratio, or did you want to have more negative when you saw that?
We could have more negative. You know, we have a rule, but we never punch down, we always punch up. And what we mean by that is if there's a gallery that, generally speaking, doesn't do great shows, that we're not all that interested in their program, and they have a show that's another show that's not that interesting, we're never going to give that show a bad review. On the contrary, if there's a gallery like that that does a show that we think is great, we try to give them a good review because we want to give them some coverage. So you don't kick somebody who you don't think is all that great to begin with, you know? And so when we do negative reviews, they tend to be of big institutions because they're not gonna get hurt. But when we have written negative reviews, I think that have been most incendiary, it's always of younger artists or, you know, and then their friends rally around them in the comments and how dare you and all that kind of stuff. So people mind it when you attack a big institution, but people mind it a lot more when you attack a young artist or the work of a young artist, I should say.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of a little bit out of left field, but how would you describe the culture of the art community in Houston and among artists as compared with any, you know, with maybe the bigger capitals? Are there any, other than being smaller, obviously, are there any distinguishing characteristics?
Well, I was talking with a friend of mine actually who moved to LA, and you're in LA, right?
I am. Thank you for doing your research.
Friend of mine moved.
I read up. No, a friend of mine moved to Los Angeles from Houston some years ago and really hates it, hates Los Angeles. And which is funny because Houston and Los Angeles have some key things in common as cities.
Yeah.
But one of the things that he said that he missed, he said everyone in Texas is a shit talker. And what he meant by that is I think that everyone's just honest in a way where people, which is funny because we have that Southern, like, you have to be polite kind of thing here. But I think in LA, people are just more hesitant to put it out there and say what their opinion is of the new museum building or say what their opinion is of the new curator's work or whatever, you know, even in conversation, even at parties. And here, nobody's ever going to hesitate to say what they really think. So
can I just jump in real quick? I would take that at least one step further and say not only are people generally hesitant here, I think they're more backstabbing. You know, they'll say diplomatic things in the room, but behind closed doors, they'll shit talk you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what he was talking about when he says he hates LA. LA has a reputation, and I've spent a good deal of time in LA, and I mean, it's a fabulous city, of course. It's awesome. But it does have this reputation of being incredibly shallow, fake positive, fake healthy, you know, and sort of full of shit. And so, and that's not the way Texans are for the most part. I think that the Texas art community is incredibly supportive, maybe sometimes to a fault. But I think in Houston, I think the working artists here would say, I think that for the most part, Houston is a really supportive city to work in. The problem, of course, is that you don't have the marketplace here. I mean, there is a marketplace here, of course, but it's easy to get to the point where you're selling work for $5,000 to $15,000 here. It's very hard to get to the point where you're selling work for $50,000 to $100,000 or more.
If you're in that first category, and you're doing, and you have somebody who's able to sell your work, you're doing well enough, are you not?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of people, the trade-off is worth it because it's livable. I mean, it's less livable than it used to be. Like everywhere else, real estate has gone through the roof here, but it not only is it livable, and I think that there is, I always quote, you know, because he's from Houston and because he's great, Bill Hicks, the late comedian, he used to talk about
he is the most quotable non-art world person.
He's the most quotable Houstonian, maybe other than Sam Houston himself, who I love, but no, Bill Hicks used to, I mean, there are other quotable Houstonians, but Bill Hicks used to talk about squeegeeing his third eye, and he was using it in the sense of using psychedelic drugs and just cleansing his perception of the universe, essentially. But I do think that there's an aspect of living in Houston where you keep your third eye squeegeed so that when you go to New York, you aren't sucked, or LA, you're not sucked in by the hype around artwork. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter that certain paintings are selling for 30, 50, 150, 300 a pop. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, because you can see the work for what it is. And you can, if it's hyped, you know, silly work that's being bought by silly people who have more money than sense, you can tell. And maybe I wonder if it's harder to tell when you're living in that world. I don't know.
Well, it is, I mean, for whatever it's worth, it's always a lot more complicated than it seems. I think there's definitely a certain amount of truth to, as I described earlier, the sort of lack of shit talking, which is to say backstab talking. But, you know, all those other things are generally a bit cliche in the false way. But mm-hmm. I think for me, the thing that most resonates of what you, the contrast you described is the supportiveness. I know there are very supportive pockets throughout LA's art community, but generally it does not, to me, who has been here for as long as Glass Tire has been around, does not feel like a particularly supportive community. And part of that is just because it's so big. You know, when you get to be so big, it feels like you're the anonymity of the big city, even if it's in a particular world. Whereas from my perspective, you know, rose-colored version of the Houston community, and maybe it really is this, but, you know, when you're smaller, it's much easier to feel like you're all part of the same team, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think it's a cultural difference. I think size certainly has something to do with it. And in the 20 years I've really been paying attention to the Houston art scene, it has grown a lot. And it has balkanized to some extent because it's just not possible to encompass the whole art scene here anymore. One thing when I think of LA, I think of the galleries are probably more hostile to artists to some degree. I mean, in terms of not hostile, that's the wrong word, but because the galleries are just operating at a higher dollar amount and with all the associated sort of ambiance, I suppose, about them and approach to doing business, I suppose, it's just not going to be this. It's not going to be as warm and supportive. But as the minute I say that, I think of dealers whom I know in LA, in New York, who are wonderful, who've been in the business a really long time and are terrific. So that's a generalization. I shouldn't say that. I don't know. I don't know what makes Texas more supportive than other places. The main thing about Texas is not that it's friendly or that it's honest, although those things are true. To me, the main thing, because I did live in New York as a young person. I did live in London. I lived in Mexico. And I never felt in those other places the sense of freedom that I feel in Texas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is such a cliche, and I'm sure there might be people just who would roll their eyes to hear that, but it really is true. There's a feeling you can do whatever the hell you want here. And that manifests itself, oh, by the way, in some very bad ways environmentally and in lots of other city planning, lots of ways, you know.
Right.
But it also, if you're interested in just an entrepreneurial mindset, and I think artists are all entrepreneurs, it's very freeing to be here. And I think there's just less of a sense of art as a career here.
Mm-hmm. I'm just letting that sink in a little bit. Mm.
I don't want to sound like a rube making these generalizations about LA because LA's great. I never go to LA and I don't have a lot of fun and see great art. So, and obviously New York as well. So it's not like they're hopeless by any means. It's just where are you going to choose to live? What's really important?
For one reason or another, the idea of let me put it this way. When you mention artists in Houston and sort of making comparisons and how, you know, the climate that you described with LA galleries initially, I wondered if it's any different in Houston and Texas in general, for that matter, if artists are not, sort of scooped up out of grad school or, you know, within those first 5 years, if that ascendance or if that sort of grooming process is any different there.
It exists a little bit. There are a few galleries who do that here, but the scale is not even in the same league as LA or New York, obviously, or, you know, with the schools in the Northeast. I mean, I think this brings up an interesting point about Texas. I was talking to Jeremy Strick, who's the director now of the Nasher Sculpture Center in Dallas, but of course was the director of MoCA previously, I was postulating to him that Texas today is like, you know, is comparable to the LA scene in the 60s, let's say, that there's all this raw energy and really exciting artists doing work that's not necessarily being paid attention to nationally. And then you have these institutions and da-da-da-da-da. And he said, yes, that's true, but you don't have the schools like we did in LA, or that there were in, let's say, the 70s, you know, mm-hmm. with CalArts and whatnot. And I said, ah, that's interesting. And of course, we in that particular conversation did not get into just what has happened with graduate school generally with MFAs. But he also made the point that was very hopeful. This is just as a side note, and I loved this, and I always think about this. And he said, but it only takes one person, you know. One person at a program, at a school, can change that school, can make it exciting, and vice versa. The loss of one person can sort of ruin a school or, you know, make it right on its past reputation. But in any event, we don't have the kind of schools in Texas that existed in LA back in the day.
Sure.
And that's the difference.
Well, meanwhile, though, allegedly, these big-time curators from the biennial shows, you know, a couple come to mind that are national, supposedly comb the country, you know, in preparation for these shows. Do you feel like over the last 10 years, for example, that Houston and or Texas artists have been seen in those lenses and represented fairly?
Oh, no, not really. Not really, but...
Do you feel like those people have missed the boat?
Well, I think that biennial curation, I don't know, it's changed so much. Like, it feels like the Whitney Biennial used to be a much bigger deal, you know? I think that people have agendas, and I think that they try to address those agendas, you know, whenever they're curating. And that's true no matter what the person's up to.
Mm-hmm.
In their defense, I think it's really, really hard to come into a city where you don't necessarily have deep ties and deep knowledge of the grassroots scene, and you're just looking at what's in galleries and in museums, you know, and you might be connecting with some studio visits or whatever, but you have to trust that the people who are telling you where to go really know what's what, you know? I mean, I wouldn't trust myself to go to Cleveland or Kansas City or Seattle and really know what's what without spending 6 months on the ground, you know? And they just can't do that in those jobs. So it's very difficult what they're trying to do.
Yeah, indeed. But at the same time, these people, just for the sake of argument, fictional scenario, they could easily come to somebody like you and say, hey, Rainey, you know, can you lay out the groundwork for me and tell me what I should go see? I'm here for, 2 weeks or a week,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yeah.
So did they not do that out of pride or, you know, what have?
Oh, no. I think it's much less sort of insidious. I just think people talk to the people that they know. And this gets us back to the monkey see, monkey do stuff, where
right.
there is a circle of people talking to each other. And they tend to come up with similar answers.
Yeah, right.
And that's not necessarily sinister. Yeah, it could be, you could argue that that's a little lazy.
Yeah, it's extremely lazy. It's extremely lazy.
Yeah.
And it's really...
I think people, and this is true of curators, sometimes lack imagination. I think that they tend to go with that which is sanctioned. I mean, curators want to cover their butts. They want to, you know, have a show that, you know, ticks the right, you know, shows that they know who's cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I know that I fall into this awful La Boheme romantic idea of unknown artists, and it's such a tempting idea to fall into, and I do resist my natural inclination to do that. I promise you, I'm not just being brainless about this. But I also do think that there are so many artists who really deserve recognition who don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many artists who really don't deserve it who do get it.
Yeah.
Now, why is that?
Yeah, and to what extent, as you say that, do you see that playing out in Houston?
Oh, I think that's true in Houston too. I think that's true everywhere.
Yeah.
So we try, you know, our goal is to shine light on that which is interesting, and that which is less well known, and to, you know, take down that which is exceedingly well known sometimes.
Yeah.
We can do Rothko quickly. My beef with Rothko, because I did write a negative review of a show here in Houston at the Museum of Fine Arts. My beef with Rothko is that I don't think he's that great of a painter. I really think he's incredibly overrated. But even more than that, what I really dislike is the religiosity around his sort of cult of personality and cult of worship. Where people,
right.
it really is a religion, I think, for some people. It's the, you know, and that's true of so much contemporary art, this secular religiosity. I mean, and there are some really obvious examples. Terrell, like, you know, Kanye just bought his way into heaven, giving that money to the Roden Crater. He's going to get into art heaven. You know, so it's like all these kind of, you know, mystical, godlike, artists, it drives me crazy, and people wearing all black solemnly and silently going and, you know, genuflecting. So that's Rothko. That's all I have to. That's really my main beef with Rothko.
And by the way, the religiosity obviously reaches its apotheosis at the Rothko Chapel, presumably, right?
Oh yeah, and I talk about the chapel. And the chapel is I actually think the chapel, while a failure, it's an architectural failure. Philip Johnson designed it, and it doesn't look great these days. And I think it's not a successful space just as a space. And I don't think that it achieves what Rothko was trying to achieve, which I think he was trying to achieve some sense of transcendence, some idea of death as this black infinitude. You know, it doesn't get you there. It doesn't get me there. But I do, that's the one thing where I'm like, I think I understand what Rothko was really trying to get at there. He didn't make it, and a lot of money was spent helping him not make it, but I do think I know what he was trying to get at. So I'm more sympathetic to the Rothko Chapel maybe than I was when I wrote that piece.
So my question then about the Rothko piece, and your opinions generally are, first of all, I guess, what kind of response have you gotten? But do you feel like the people that maybe matter the most in terms of, maybe I should preface the feedback that you've gotten this way. Does anybody care what you have to say about him? Not, and I don't mean that in a condescending or what have you way. It's more, it's too late, right? Because he's so canonized, obviously, that, I mean, are the guardians of culture in the museums. Is there any way to change that conversation?
Oh, no, I don't think anyone... I have no expectation of changing the reverence that he receives, the prices that his works get at auction. No. I would never, you know... Let me disabuse you of any idea that I think what I say is going to change that paradigm. Which kind of speaks to the point of what I was saying earlier, like to artists, why do it if you're not going to become an art star in New York? Well, because, you know, what else are you going to do with your life? And here's something where if you work really hard and put something out there that you feel good about, it is hard sometimes to feel like you're not getting the recognition or you're not having the effect on the culture that you see other people getting or having. But you have to, you know what is satisfying to you in your life, I suppose. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to me, to put an article out there that I worked very, very hard on and that I felt very good about in terms of it being a solid piece of writing, was enough.
Yeah. And I'm somebody who, like, I think a lot of people probably listening and who are artists themselves, I'm somebody that's probably very on the fence about Rothko, and I feel I could, you don't have to pull my arm that hard to sell me on your angle at all. So I think, you know, speaking both of shit talking and of, you know, being sort of an influencer among contemporary artists, you know, I think you could have an impact in that way. You know, it's kind of the way that this podcast is is sort of having an invisible impact. You know, like I maybe hear every 6 months, you know, or something from somebody who, you know, I really enjoyed that or whatever. You know what I mean? It's kind of like that for you, right?
Well, and this is sort of the larger issue of the world we're all swimming in right now, where, I mean, I read recently that we're people today are receiving, I think, 6 times as much information as they were in 1960. I read this somewhere recently, which right. makes perfect sense. I mean, if you think about it, and it's very easy in such an environment to think like, well, shit, why even bother? But if you don't bother, then, you know what? I don't know what else you're gonna do. You know?
Yeah, I really love Rainey's sentiment there, and just about everywhere else. And there is so much more great insight and postulating from her in part 2 for you to look forward to next episode. And it does get much more positive, for what it's worth. If you're at all worried, we will pick things back up next episode. So look forward to that. Thank you again to Rainey. Before we get to what one bedrooms are renting for in the costliest U.S. markets and Houston, the Mapplethorpe biopic, and some great old news, which coincidentally includes 2 clips on, guess who? Mark Rothko. I want to give a big thanks to Andy Davis for his assistance with the edit. Did any of you go check out his show on the Bowery, by the way, that I mentioned last episode, across from the new museum? Let me know if you did. Would love to hear from you. All right. So here we go. Before we get into rents, just a quick note on the Mapplethorpe biopic, which came out. I think it's just called Mapplethorpe, right? Have any of you seen it? I would love to hear from you. I have not. I just heard part of a breakdown from a couple of critics on this local show called Film Week on KPCC, and they both trashed it. So it does not sound very encouraging for sophisticated film viewers. It sounds like it was guilty of a lot of the biopic cliches, from what I gathered. So anybody, if anybody's seen it, would love to hear from you. All right, on to rents for what I found this in the Times, and sort of in our ongoing discussion of real estate, particularly in relation to being an artist in an expensive city, I thought this was interesting and relevant. And it's also about change in the rent rates, which I think is the surprising part, because the premise is that in New York, rents actually for one bedrooms actually went down over the past year. So here is the list. How one bedroom rents changed over a year, starting with San Francisco, up 5% to $3,580 median price for a one bedroom in San Francisco. And if you're curious to hear a lot more about the challenges of living in San Francisco, I highly recommend you go check out my last episode with Antonio on the How I Get By podcast. That's How I Get By. You can look it up on whatever platform you use or on the website, howigetbypodcast.com. Thank you very much for doing that. Second, New York, $2,780 per month, and that's down 3%. San Jose, which is, of course, in the Bay Area, $2,530. That's up 3 points. Boston, $2,420. That's up 5 points. Los Angeles, $2,400. That's up 8% in Los Angeles for a one bedroom. Oakland, $2,370. That's up 13%. So that's the biggest change. And that goes, again, back to the Bay Area's tight, tight market. Washington, D.C., $2,130. That's down 7% for a one bedroom. Seattle, $1,940. That's up 6%. San Diego, $1,910. That's up 12%, and Santa Ana, finally, which is in Orange County, and this was pretty surprising that Santa Ana is in the top 10. I did not know Santa Ana to be a hot market, but I guess all the various arts organizations and whatnot there are really lifting the level of rent. $1,780, and that's up 8% for a one bedroom. Now, meanwhile, you probably want to know, well, what about Houston? What about Texas? Where does that fall in the rent area. And I just looked, did a quick search. And so rentcafe.com gives us the average rent in Houston, Texas, last updated March 2019, $1,092, average size 879 square feet. Year-to-year change, 2%. That's pretty freaking sweet. So when Rainey mentioned the increasing market rate for Houston, I don't know. Okay, maybe that's relative to Texas, but that's still pretty reasonable for a one-bedroom. All right, enough about real estate. Let's get on to the old news. Big thanks to Megan Bickle for combing through these. And Megan, by the way, preface this one with, smells like another round of zombie formalism. And here's how this one goes. It's from Art Forum. New art fair to showcase work by MFA graduates. A new art fair dedicated to the work of emerging artists is coming to New York this fall. The Brooklyn-based event company that produces Art on Paper, Art Market San Francisco, and the Seattle Art Fair, among other cultural events. The MFA Fair aims to showcase recent graduates from Masters of Fine Art programs who are making exceptional work. The MFA Fair seeks to operate as a coordinated effort to expand art world visibility for both the graduating class and the MFA programs, a bridge between academia and industry. That sounds a lot like an advertisement, Art Forum. How much did you get paid for that? Okay. Couple from Martin Herbert, or Herbert. TFW, you're asked what you do, and you have to say, write about art. And every single other thing you could possibly have done with your life flashes through your mind. And the second one from Martin Herbert. The year is 2093, and most of the century's contemporary art is in one giant landfill, but you still have to pay to enter it. Okay, this is from Atlas Obscura. The job that will let you do whatever you want in a Swedish train station forever. In 2025, applications will be accepted for the job of a lifetime, literally. A fair starting salary with annual wage increases that match those for Swedish government workers, vacation time, even a pension. And the job is yours for as long as you do it. So what's the job? Anything you want. Each morning, the chosen employee will punch a clock in Korsvagen train station, currently under construction in Gothenburg, Sweden, which will turn on a bank of bright fluorescent lights. Other than that, quote, the position holds no duties or responsibilities besides the fact that the work should be carried out at Korsvagen. Whatever the employee chooses to do constitutes the work, unquote, reads the job description. The employee can also choose how publicly visible or anonymous they would like to be while on the clock. Eternal Employment is the brainchild of Swedish artistic duo Simon Golden and Jakob Seneby. For this project, they are investing a prize from Public Art Agency Sweden in conjunction with the Swedish Transport Administration, about $650,000. This forms the Eternal Employment Foundation, which will grow this initial sum and form a board to select and pay the forever employee. Anyone in the world can apply and, quote, the foundation will be an equal opportunity employer, unquote, Golden and Seneby say over email. And when the employee retires or chooses to leave, the board will select another. Again, that's from Atlas Obscura. That sounds like just about all of our dream jobs, doesn't it? Except, of course, you know, the fact that it's in Sweden. From Christopher Knight, in a market-dominated art world, some museums feel they aren't doing their job unless they're busy shopping. And this references a piece on artsjournal.com, Roth over Rothko, SF Momo's distasteful disposal about selling a Rothko at the height of his from the height of his career. And it has a picture of the San Francisco Museum of Art's Neil Benezra, who is shopping, I guess, at an art fair. And then the second one, I wish I could find some way to tell you how I feel about Jackson, Mark Rothko writes to Lee Krasner. Rothko's letter is held by the Archives of American Art as part of the papers and photographs of Pollock and Krasner, which have been archived in the form of more than 15,000 images. That's from Art News. And finally, from Art News, and this is vintage Jeff Weiss in old news form. And here's our complete coverage of Armory Week. That's it. That's all the coverage you get. And this is actually still new news, isn't it? Because as if you're listening to this, the weekend of the 9th and 10th of March, the Armory Week is still going on. So let me give it to you one more time. And here's our complete coverage of Armory Week. Nice. All right, I mentioned Mapplethorpe. I mentioned old news. If you would like to support the show financially other than the Patreon $10 a month platform, you can certainly donate to the show via PayPal, Venmo, or good old-fashioned check. You can also support the show non-financially by leaving a great review on iTunes or whatever platform you listen on, following on social media at Artist Podcast, sharing with your friends, and you can certainly propose guests to the show. And just one final note before we go, I am always open to proposals of people to be on the show, but I do need you to make a very compelling argument as to why they're a good fit, okay? Because I do get pitches on an ongoing basis, but you need to understand how your proposal fits into the show. And I can certainly have a conversation with you about that if it's not clear. All right, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for being here, and I hope you are looking forward to part two with Rainey Knutson next episode. I will talk to you then. Ciao for now.